lost in the fog of a cosmic storm. Floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light. Riding the waves that are just out of sight.
Welcome back to Whimsical Wavelengths. Today, the pod shows its fitness with impeccable wordplay. That's right, today's episode is for the birds. At least those which have a ravenous appetite for knowledge. Seriously, though, I mean, unless you live in a true concrete jungle, what often wakes you up as the sun comes up? Birds. Who naturally keeps pests down like insects that eat our crops? Birds. Who helps with pollination and seed dispersion? Birds. Who scavenges and cleans up carcasses? That's birds. Whose whimsical wavelengths of sound serenade our ears, providing inspiration like the famous poem Ode to a Nightingale from 1819 by John Keats? The answer, if you're following along, is birds. The point is, they fill a wide variety of ecological niches, which are specific roles or positions within an ecosystem. Bald eagles are the apex predator in their range. Vultures are scavengers. Hummingbirds feed from flowers and help pollination. Understanding how bird populations and behaviors are changing due to changes in environment. Climate change. human actions and the like. With all the different ecological niches birds fill around us, it's kind of important. That's why I didn't want to wing it on this topic. Because A, I know very little about birds, and B, I am really looking to learn. Especially after finding out about citizen science campaigns that occur every year. By the time I record and release this episode, February will be in the rearview mirror. But the Great Backyard Bird Count took place from February 14th to 17th, and the Christmas Bird Count runs from December 14th to January 5th every year. And the Christmas Bird Count is the longest-running citizen science survey in the world. That means everyone can get involved. Links are in the show notes. Today, though, we are going to get technical. Our guest has research that takes place in what I can best describe, or as I guess, is as close as we can get to lab conditions in the natural world. The site for her work is the Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest, located in New Hampshire.
Please welcome Miranda Zamorelli, a PhD candidate at Dartmouth College, obtained her bachelor's from the University of Rochester, and has put in time being a field assistant with the Salt Marsh Sparrow Research Initiative, plus so much more. Most importantly for us today, she's agreed to share her work. Thank you, and thanks for being here.
Thanks, Jeff, for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. And every guest who's come on to Whimsical Wavelengths, and I think this goes for all researchers that get in to be a PhD, have a story about how they came to be who they are, or where they are, for that matter. For you, I see a track record that is long, and I'll let you go into it. How did you end up on the scientific journey that you're currently on in grad school?
Yeah, so I was in high school when I decided I want to get a PhD. I think that's pretty young, but I loved learning. I knew I wanted to continue my educational journey. At the time, I thought I was going to get a PhD in anthropology. I thought learning about human cultures and human society and decision making through the human lens would be really exciting, and I did enjoy it. I majored in anthropology at the University of Rochester, but as I was getting more in these cultural anthropology classes, I was interested in the biological angle of human decision making and what makes us human. And so I ended up double majoring with another degree in brain and cognitive sciences. And through that, I took an animal behavior course that really just changed my life. I had no idea I could get a career studying animals, let alone birds, which is what I really focus on now. I held a bird as part of a field trip, and a semester abroad in Australia confirmed this for me. And when I graduated college, I started volunteering with the Salt Marsh Sparrow Research Initiative, fell in love more with the field work of studying animal behavior, and eventually applied to grad school, and now I'm here.
Awesome. Yeah, I feel like lots of people who end up getting PhDs, although they don't come at it as young as you or even I did, because I knew well before high school that I was going to go down this road. But I feel like there's always these twists and turns with a lot of people where they start, especially for geology, they start one way, take this one course that really speaks to them, and then deviation stage left. So that's pretty cool. But I noticed in some of your background that you then, I guess, springboarded from the bachelor's into like volunteering or working with birds, right?
Yeah. So I graduated in 2020, which was a great time to graduate, especially with the degree and experience working in museums and libraries. So I decided, you know, if I can't find a job right now until things open up a little bit more, which eventually they did, and I found a job, let me volunteer. I had the opportunity and the resources to do that. So salt marsh sparrows were my in.
Yeah, it's amazing how volunteering can really bring you back into academia as well and set you up for that, because I obviously did something similar with HVO.
Yeah.
So some researchers work in a lab with model organisms. Some use wavelengths of electromagnetic waves from distant sources collected by giant mirrors. Your research takes place in the Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest. So what is an experimental forest?
An experimental forest is a place where researchers can come and study ecosystems and their environment. So Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest is one of, I think, 70 different experimental forests in the U.S. And it's just a great place for researchers to come and manipulate and study the environment.
So, I mean, how are they changed over time? Are they expected to just be left natural, or is there logging? Is there mining? Like, what does it mean to be an experimental forest?
Yeah, so some parts of the experimental forest are untouched. So no one looks at them. It's a reference for any manipulations that are done. For example, some manipulations that happen are they chop down all the trees in a watershed. And a watershed is just an area of land where all water that enters the system, usually via rain or snow, falls into or eventually ends up into a central stream. And that stream of water throws into a larger stream and eventually ends up at the ocean. And so, you know, logging parts of the trees or some trees to see how that might change water flow or how that might affect bird communities or insect abundance. So that's the purpose of an experimental forest. Other manipulations could occur too. Like there's a study at Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest where they pile on snow to parts of the forest and then also remove snow in parts of the forest in the middle of winter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, but they look at how that changes like the nutrients of the soil and water flow in the system.
So the forest becomes your laboratory. You're not wearing white coats, you're wearing high vis, but the idea is the same.
Exactly.
Okay, so you study birds within the experimental forest at the Hubbard Brook. What are the subjects or in the birds or the characters in your scientific story? Like, who are they?
For my scientific story in particular, I focus on one species bird mostly, and that's called the oven bird. It's a small bird, about 20 grams. That's like 20 paper clips, right? And these little tiny birds are amazing. They spend their spring and summer months in New Hampshire, where Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest is located, but also in the northeastern United States and Canada, and also the Midwest U.S. and Canada as well. And then they spend their fall and winters down in the Caribbean on a tropical vacation. And they make these amazing dome-shaped nests that look like old-fashioned pizza ovens. And that's how they get their name, the oven bird. So that's like my central character. Of course, I care and study many of the other birds at Hubbard Brook too, mostly the migratory ones.
So is it just the oven shape of their nests that make them special?
I think they're also one of the loudest birds in the forest. That is a key feature. They're one of the first birds you hear, when you're walking through the forest, just because they're so loud.
I see. So I guess you could say you have to do your research there. And when your subject of your study is wild, you kind of have to join them. You have to study them where they are. So the field site for the technical part we've mostly covered, I guess. Now I ask the toughest question, and no, I perhaps don't ask this of every single person that comes on, because sometimes I have my own framing, and sometimes I'm like, I actually don't know how to frame this because I'm a geophysicist and not a biologist or ornithologist. So What is the most plain, general, overarching description of your research questions?
I like to tell people I study the relationships among habitat selection, reproductive success, and singing behavior of migratory songbirds. Simply put, my question is, do birds sing more or less depending on the quality of their habitat? And quality can be defined by, you know, how much food is in that habitat, in that space that they're living. You know, if there's a lot of food, that's great. And maybe the birds are singing, or their singing behavior is changing because of that. Or are they producing a lot of young in that space, in that habitat? And maybe their singing behavior is changing because of that too.
I guess to try to get some background, you've sent me some journal articles so that you've been either an author or a co-author on. So thanks for that. And feel free to correct and expand absolutely everything I am saying. But generally, the science we're discussing today starts with a search. Like, you got to find the birds or identify them first. Like, how do you go about that process to find and identify them? You're not just walking through and just like hearing them, right? Like, there's more to it than that.
Hearing them is a big part of it. We identify our birds mostly first via song. So every individual species sounds different. So a black-throated blue warbler sounds different from the oven bird, which sounds different from a woodpecker. And even different woodpeckers don't sound the same. So, you know, going to where we hear that sound and then using our binoculars and really trying to see, okay, where is that bird singing? Where is that bird drumming? Drumming is when woodpeckers, you know, back against the trees. Where is that happening? Can we see it? And, you know, zeroing in on the location of that bird, that's what we do next.
So you use sight and sound, but you're also, I guess, somewhere along the way also incorporating different technologies. I mean, we're, as volcanologists, we're doing more than just looking at the volcano, we're listening to it. So I understand there's some like acoustic scanners that can help you identify specimens and their sweet, whimsical wavelengths. Honestly, it starts to sound a bit like you're using spy gadgets. You're not an oven bird. The vault will not open. Is that really a thing, and how is it being used? And then secondarily, like, there must be some birds that you have a hard time identifying if you're using sound all the time.
Yeah, so we use these tools called passive acoustic recording units. So you basically take a gray box or a green box, depending on the recorder you're using, you strap it on to a tree, and then you set it to run. And our recorders operate from 5 a.m. to 8 a.m. every single morning. So when I, at the end of the season, take down that recorder and listen, what birds did it pick up? Now I can, you know, if I missed a bird when I was walking through, or I didn't go in the field on June 15th, the recorder picked up what birds were singing that day. So it's a really great way to retroactively go back when we get that data and see what birds were there. What were they doing? How often were they singing? Was that species there? Yes or no? And of course, there's some challenges with that too. So, you know, oven bird, we're picking up because they're so loud. We're picking up oven birds pretty far away. But some birds definitely don't sing as frequently, or they sing softer songs, so they can be more challenging to detect on recorders. And there's work being done comparing, you know, human observations to a recorder. But I would say the recorders really help supplement the work humans are doing. And, you know, recorder, you, like I said, you place it and you let it go. So if that field site is up the top of a mountain and really difficult and challenging to get at every single day, you go up there a couple times to replace the battery and you're getting great data, or at least data that tells you roughly what is there.
So I guess my next question is kind of, again, two-parters, but can you use their song to identify individual birds? Like, is there like a blueprint, like a thumbprint to some birds and the way they sing?
Yeah, so birds of different species, absolutely. Birds of the same species, there's work being done right now to use models to, or like different pieces of technology to ID, okay, this is bird A, this is bird B, this is bird C. So that work is being done now, and it's getting better as the technology improves.
Are you using machine learning, I guess AI learning, to be able to do that? Because I can't imagine a human ear being able to pick that up.
Yeah, machine learning is what we mostly use to ID individuals of the same species. Although sometimes when you're spending so much time with birds in the fields, you pick up on the differences. I don't know how much of time I have for an anecdote, but there was this one bird this summer that made its classic oven bird song and then had a little extra note at the end. So we always knew it was him singing. He was the only bird on our study area making that little note. Or some oven birds sing a little faster. They have these things called trills, which is sort of, you know, these different, the notes. And some sing these notes very fast, some sing a little slower. So you pick up on it. Of course, it's not as technically accurate as a machine learning model, but it's something. And it's fun just to even notice that casually, even if you're not putting this, you know, scientific backing behind it all the time.
Do you have any mimickers in your field site, like crows, or there's others that would just completely mimic different things? I think we have a stellar jay here in BC that is a pretty decent mimicker.
They say that blue jays will try to mimic red-tailed hawks when they have their normal calls. We have those. We have ravens occasionally will come and make a sound or in recordings, but not like a typical mimicker, like a northern mockingbird or a gray catbird, those classic examples of mimickers in the northeastern U.S. that we see. We don't, on the parts of Hubbard Brook where we're focusing our research, they're not really there.
Okay, and just, I know this goes beyond your research, but expanding the use of these remote audio recorders, and I gather even though they're mimicking to a human ear, we may not be able to understand or distinguish the difference, but machine learning should be able to go like, this is something still different, right?
Yeah, machine learning should be able to pick up on those subtle differences, especially if it's well-trained and you have a lot of examples of this is what a gray catbird sounds like when it's mimicking something versus what the actual bird might sound like.
Right. Okay, so now we're going to attempt to get more technical and I'll do my best to keep up. So when the average person thinks of fitness, they're probably thinking like, yeah, I'm going to go to the gym, going to get swole, I'm going to get like exercise. However, fitness doesn't really mean that in the context of biology, at least not really. So what does it mean within your studies?
Fitness means it's the organism's ability to survive and reproduce. That's really all it is. What is the chance that the bird, adult bird in our system, survive from one year to the next? And how many nestlings is it producing?
Okay, so I guess the next question is a bit, how do you measure fitness? Because I assume, like science, we always try to measure something. We're trying to give it a quantitative number. So how do we take those choices of habitat and change through time and give it a number?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one thing we do is we go out in the field and we mark bird territories. So these birds are territorial. They have their little area where they try to survive and reproduce, where they try to have maintain their fitness. And so we go out and we try to map those. And one of the ways we do this is by actually catching the birds in nets called mist nets. And once we catch a bird, we can color band it. So we give the birds three colorful bands. So they might be like red, blue, green, or some combination of colors, and then aluminum band with a unique ID number. And now we know that's this bird. And every time we see that bird, we know this is where it's roughly staying in this region. So we can get the size of its territory, roughly where it's located. We also search for nests. So when we find a dome-shaped oven bird nest, we can count how many eggs it has, you know, how many of those eggs hatch. Do those eggs that hatch as nestlings, do they eventually leave the nest or do they get eaten? What's going on there? That's how we really try to put numbers, measuring territory size, measuring how many nestlings are leaving a nest or leaving a territory.
So those are all the qualitative things that go into giving a fitness number.
Yeah.
And I gather there's a formula or a set procedure somewhere to provide a fitness number. Am I just completely misunderstanding and fitness isn't like given a number like 4.1 and then you can see how it tracks over time?
You know, because we individually ID these birds, we know, okay, of the birds we marked in year one, how many returned in year two. So 65% return, that means for this population, the fitness of adult survival is 65%. If we find 59 nests, let's say, or 60 nests, let's round up, and 30 of them successfully had nestlings, that probably means there's a, you know, a young survival or reproductive output that is 50%, you know? So that's maybe how we're putting numbers into, you know, this is the fitness of survival. This is how we're measuring fitness via reproduction.
One way you look at bird populations at dynamics and how they change is quantifying the size of territory, as you've already described. But what does territory mean to a bird? Like, they're not exactly building castles and planting flags. So, like, how do you determine the territory of something?
I think the best way to determine the territory is first defining sort of why birds sing. And birds sing for two reasons. One, to attract mates. And then the other reason is actually to defend their territories. So many times when you're walking through the forest or through a grassland and you hear a bird sing, it's actually telling its next door neighbor, hey, this is my home, this is my space, stay away. And when that bird sings, its next door neighbor will respond and sing back. This is my space, stay away. And this is called countersinging. They'll go back and forth singing all morning long. And they're basically having this like territorial rap battle, trying to say, this is my space, stay away. And when you have multiple recordings that you're writing down and saying, this is where this bird was, this is where it sang, this is when its neighbor responded, this is where the neighbor was when it responded, you can have an idea of roughly where these boundaries are, somewhere in between these two birds going back and forth.
Okay, so you determine the rough size based on where it's singing, essentially, in its different locations within its territory.
Yes.
Okay. Just to pull a little bit more jargon speak, there seems to be two general models to describe kind of what we're talking about when we start having more of one species in the same area vying for the same resources. Ideal free distribution and ideal despotic distribution. And I guess I get to make it super simplistic to say, roughly speaking, equal sharing versus bullies get the larger slice of the pie. Is that kind of roughly speaking what we're talking about? Or you're talking about?
I would agree with that. I think, you know, with an ideal free distribution, you know, you have X number of birds in a space, and some will go to the best quality habitats. Maybe there's the most food there, and there'll be more individuals there because there's more resources there for them to split amongst themselves. And all the other birds will end up in maybe this poor quality habitat. There's less food, but there's fewer of them, so they're not vying for resources or trying to really fight for space super intensely. But then with ideal despotic distribution, you have those bullies, those dominant individuals, those despots. And in that case, you have a couple really tough individuals that are always going to be in the best quality habitat, the highest quality, having all the food to themselves, and they'll force everyone else into the poor quality habitat.
Okay. I guess a follow-on question, because a lot of models, they're end members and then they're often somewhere in between. Is this a similar thing for that in science as well? These are two end members and usually populations fall somewhere between?
Yeah, these are two competing theories and maybe, you know, they follow one or the other.
But is that what you're asking? Well, I was more curious, like, let me think of a good example. Just going back to volcanology here, and because that's where I'm going, when you have deformation at the Earth's surface and it's a volcano, there's two general possibilities. You can have the hydrothermal system, which is much closer to the Earth's surface causing the deformation, or you can have magma. And so you can treat those as two completely different theories and have them completely separate, or it's a combination of the two. So it's more of a question, is this like, is it usually somewhere between these two competing theories? Like, is there some dominance that still play out, but they are relatively good at sharing, or are they truly distributing the wealth equally?
When we were initially testing for these theories and the system, you know, we thought there could be a little bit more of a spectrum in how they follow one of these two theories. Maybe there is some dominance playing out, but maybe it's not as perfectly and clean cut. You know, nothing in nature is as clean cut. And we were looking at these theories, and the, you know, the paper we wrote about this in seven different species. So maybe we thought some birds would follow one, some birds would follow the other, and there's, you know, again, some you know, maybe some would follow one more closely compared to another. I think there could potentially be more of a spectrum, but what we found was a pretty good indicator of ideal free distribution. When we found that there was an ideal free distribution, you know, it didn't follow even our hypotheses like perfectly what we were seeing, but it was a good indicator. So I would say, yeah, there is a bit of a spectrum going on.
Was there any changes or any nuance to the data as you had different stresses on the number, like due to numbers or food availability? Was there one situation that ended up being more shared equally versus another?
We found that if there's more birds in a year of that species, territory size will shrink. So when you have a lot of birds coming in, their territory sizes too sort of will shrink because of that, because there's more birds. So they're almost quote unquote making space, you know, to loosely put it, for one another. And that was seen on whether or not these birds are living on highly preferred habitat or less preferred habitat. You know, let's pretend if there was more food available in the most preferred habitat, those birds were shrinking their territories significantly.
Interesting. So they're better at sharing than us humans. And there must be a specific, I guess, evolutionary point to this, right? This allows them to carry on as a population or gives them some advantage, I would imagine.
I would say so. It keeps their populations probably pretty stable because they're flexible to the number of individuals that surround them.
Okay. So this is a wild laboratory. It's at least as close as we can get to in the wild. I think it can be, I mean, you're going the best you can to either control the variables or introduce them in the most controlled manner possible. So I think it's now time to try to take a step back to the bigger picture and extrapolate. And one of the most common topics when talking about the natural environment is climate change. How does your data help us, or perhaps could help us in the future, to start talking about these sorts of changes?
So birds have this flexibility to adjust their territory size in relation to abundance. And maybe this flexibility could potentially mean they could respond to climate change in a way that allows them to be a little more resilient. And that's, you know, potentially a hopeful finding, but something we might see. I think one thing I want to say about this is, you know, we're, like you said, you cannot change in the environment, you know, on a large scale. You cannot manipulate for the research or keep things the same. So we have to go along with these changes that we're seeing occurring in the world. And one thing we notice is that springs are getting earlier and that autumns are getting later. And that extends the time that birds might have to breed. And how birds might respond to that, we're not really sure yet. You know, they could come earlier and try to produce more young during the spring and summertime, and maybe that'll be great for their populations. Or because they're coming earlier, the insects aren't out yet, or a freeze comes later in the spring, and now the birds are cold and they're not going to produce as much as we were anticipating. And you could see things happen as they're getting ready to leave as well. So I think being aware of how the climate is changing and how that could affect the systems we're studying and the data we're seeing be produced as a result of these studies, you know, is important to remember.
In the intro, I gave some examples of citizen science for bird watching and stuff. And that always happens around, I shouldn't say always, but most of that data is collected around urban areas. So I assume there's similar studies looking at territory and fitness within the urban setting as well. Are you aware of anything that might we can talk about in that regard? Because I know that there's definitely going to be people that are going to be tuning in who are part of that community and would be interested to see like how some of that, maybe not their data, but data from the urban sites that they know and love get used.
Right. I think, you know, that backyard bird count just occurred a little bit ago, and looking at how birds are doing in the winter, like, are their populations going down as a result of, you know, changes in the winter environment over time? You know, that's really valuable. I think I want to, you know, plug for citizen science. It's really great. There's an app called Merlin that you can use to, if you hear a bird, you can hold out your phone. It's a phone application, and it'll tell you what birds you're roughly hearing using that machine learning technology that we talked about earlier. In regards to birds in urban environments, you know, they're obviously doing, you know, pigeons, European starlings, house sparrows. It's kind of exact concrete research, maybe I'm a little less familiar with, but I think it's interesting to see that these birds are able to survive in an urban environment. Cardinals, chickadees, tufted titmice, these are the birds we see in urban environments in the northeastern U.S. And, you know, maybe that's a sign that some birds will really thrive if there's more urban. Of course, there are birds that need forests, that need grasslands, but at least there's some individuals that can do okay in an urban setting.
The app you just mentioned, is that one of those, is it for free? Like anyone can download it? And
Merlin is free.
Perfect. You please give me the link, or maybe I'll look it up afterwards so it can go in the show notes. Because too often, especially for things like plant identification and rocks, it's like free with in-app purchases. And you're like, ugh, you're stealing my data.
No, Merlin is great. It is free app developed by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. It can help you ID birds based on pictures and sounds and descriptions. Of course, you know, and the data you're getting, if you're like, wait a minute, maybe there's a little mistake, let me make a note of that. You know, you're helping build the data set and making the app better.
Okay, so the data that you record and stuff goes back to the science as well? So it's like citizen science. I was missing that part. Is it just for you, or does it also send data back?
It also sends data back. You can connect it. Birders who are, you know, have eBird accounts, which is another free app that you can have, where you can make lists of the birds you see, you know, in your backyard, or whether you're driving 6 hours away to find a rare bird, because people do that. I've gone pretty far to find birds. I do enjoy it as a hobby as well. But, you know, they communicate with one another, these applications, you know, so you can say, this is my bird, and then record it in eBird, and then that goes back for citizen science.
Sweet. I'll definitely add those to the show notes if any listeners are interested. And go even further afield here. Science is always moving. It doesn't really matter which field you're in, whether it's anthropology, biology, physics, whatever. They all are moving forward. How do you think your field is going to advance into the future? Is there like some tea leaves you can read? Is there technology that you know is there, but we're just underutilized at the moment? Or
I think the key for moving forward is this technology, you know, making these machine learning models better. So when I'm pulling, you know, days of recordings, I can throw it in a machine learning model and it can tell me what birds are there. We're close, but we're not perfectly there yet. You know, being able to ID individuals with these machine learning models, individuals of the same species, we're getting there and moving forward. You know, being able to survey our environment. One thing I've messed around a bit with my PhD is using LIDAR, light detecting and ranging. Basically, this technology takes a 3D image of the area or setting. So for me, I'm taking a 3D image of the forest. You know, getting that technology in a place where we can be like, okay, this is how many leaves are there. This is how much dead wood is on the ground that birds could use. You know, these type of, especially again, the acoustics one is what I'm really invested in. And that's really going to, I think, send us forward.
Okay. So before we move to the traditional last question, anything you want to add? Anything we missed? Any questions that I didn't get to?
No, I think I really wanted to make sure I said like why birds sing. I think that's important to understand that. You know, everyone thinks birds are singing because they're happy and they're singing all these wonderful songs, and maybe they are singing and doing better reproductively. But the purpose of singing is not to tell everyone they're happy and okay. The purpose is they're defending their territories and also trying to find a partner for the breeding season.
Right. It could be a lot more vulgar than what our ears are actually thinking.
A little bit.
Yeah. Okay. So the traditional last question that I ask every guest, even if they come on multiple times, I will ask them multiple times if that ever happens. What is your favorite science joke?
So this is a joke. My technicians told me my first field season studying the oven birds, and I carried on to everyone who I've worked with on this project. So do you want to hear my impression of an oven bird?
Of course.
Hey, yo, it's me, an oven bird. That's the joke.
Awesome. I like how they're always such an eclectic collection of jokes. And I think that's the whole point. Science is something that is kind of strange that way. So thanks for coming on. And I hope everyone listening enjoys being whimsically serenaded by our voices all about the birds.
Thank you for having me.
Well, another episode of Whimsical Wavelengths has come to an end. But don't worry, in 2 weeks' time, I'll be back here for your auditory dose of science, ready to whimsically serenade your eardrums. Before you go, make sure that if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show so that way you don't miss. If you've already subscribed, leave a rating. Tell a friend. Remember, this podcast is going to grow because of you guys. Also, you can grab me and talk to me on social media, interact with me there, provide some suggestions on future shows, maybe even just ask me some questions. See you in 2 weeks.
Lost in the fog of a cosmic storm, floating on whimsical wavelengths is the norm. Dancing through the stars, chasing spectrums of light. Riding the waves that are just out of sight. In a world so chaotic that misbehaves, melodies that echo show us six always. Colors intertwine, painting the sky. We're lost in the rhythm as the universe flies by. Oh, we're tuned in, feeling the beat of the unknown. Can you hear it? It's echoing through your bones. In this melodic maze, we